Welcome and thank you for joining us for another episode of KPMG's Inside International Tax, a podcast devoted to recent developments, observations, and trends related to U.S. international tax. I'm one of your hosts, Gary Scanlon, a principal in KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Kristen Gamboa, a managing director in the same group. Hey, Kristen.
Hey, Gary.
About a year ago, we examined President Trump's sweeping tariffs on U.S. trading partners. The issue is back in the spotlight because on February 20th, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a 6-3 decision in Learning Resources, Inc. versus Trump, held that one of the statutes the administration relied on, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA, does not authorize the president to impose tariffs. In this episode, we'll unpack what that ruling really means. We'll discuss its implications for importers, whether importers and consumers might see refunds for tariffs paid under IEEPA, and what this decision signals for Trump's trade policy more broadly. For our discussion today, we're joined by Lou Abad, a principal in KPMG's WNT Trade and Customs Practice, making his second appearance on the podcast. Welcome to the show, Lou.
Thanks, Gary. Thanks for having me back.
So as a refresher, early last year, President Trump rolled out a wide range of new tariffs, relying on several different legal authorities and invoking several different goals. First, there were the so-called reciprocal tariffs, aimed at reducing trade deficits by raising duties on imports from virtually all U.S. trading partners, with rates that varied by country. Second, the administration imposed tariffs on imports from Mexico, Canada, and China, justifying them as a response to the flow of illegal drugs and other contraband entering the United States from or through those countries, and also imposed tariffs on imports from Brazil and India for other reasons. Third, there were industry-specific tariffs, including a 50% tariff on all steel and aluminum imports, framed as a way to protect domestic manufacturing and strengthen critical supply chains. The Supreme Court's recent decision focused specifically on the tariffs imposed under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA. That category included both the reciprocal tariffs and the tariffs on imports from Mexico, Canada, and China that were justified as tools to combat illegal drugs. The Court of International Trade has subsequently ordered that all tariffs imposed under IEEPA be included in refund settlement, including those imposed on imports from Brazil and India. The IEEPA tariffs are at the heart of the Learning Resources, Inc. versus Trump case that we'll be discussing today. So to start us off, Lou, could you give us a quick summary of the court's reasoning in the Learning Resources case, and specifically why the court held that IEEPA does not give the president the right to impose tariffs?
Sure thing, Kristen. And just by way of background, the IEEPA statute generally allows the president broad authority to take action if there's a national emergency. And typically, this statute's been used to impose sanctions on foreign adversaries, for example. But Trump used that authority to enact tariffs in this case, which had never been done before. And the court said that the IEEPA statute, which allows the president to, quote, regulate the importation of property, unquote, to address unusual and extraordinary threats, does not provide the president the authority to impose tariffs. Although it was a 6-3 majority decision, there was no majority rationale, as the justices were divided 3-3-3. The Chief Justice Roberts, joined by Justices Gorsuch and Barrett, leaned heavily on the major questions doctrine to reason that Congress would not have delegated highly consequential power through ambiguous language. In other words, authority of vast economic or political significance must be explicitly or clearly delegated, and the justices felt that the IEEPA statute in this case was ambiguous at best. Now, the three liberal justices, Kagan, Sotomayor, and Jackson, agreed with the decision outcome, but reasoned that traditional tools of statutory interpretation were sufficient to reach the same outcome without having to apply or invoke the major questions doctrine. And then the other three conservative justices, Kavanaugh, Alito, and Thomas, dissented, reasoning that the IEEPA statute provides clear congressional authority based in part on its context, even though the language did not explicitly state tariffs. So we got one outcome and a principal decision, but no clear majority rationale for why the tariffs were invalid.
As I mentioned earlier, IEEPA was only one of several authorities on which Trump relied to impose tariffs. How does the court's ruling affect tariffs that were imposed under other authorities, if at all?
It really doesn't. These other tariffs are based on separate and independent statutes. So the Section 232 are industry-specific tariffs, and they're still in effect. And so are some of the Section 301 tariffs, which are imposed for unfair trade practices. Those are still in effect, stemming back from Trump's first term. And in addition, the new tariffs were imposed under Section 122, which allows the president to issue tariffs to address, quote, large and serious imbalance of payment deficits. These are across-the-board tariffs, generally applying to all imported goods from all trading partners, currently at a rate of 10%, but are only effective for 150 days by statute. The statute, however, allows the president to impose a maximum of 15% tariffs, which the president did threaten, but has not yet taken action to increase the rate. So we currently remain at 10%.
So you said that the tariffs are only effective for 150 days. What happens after the 150 days?
The tariffs would expire unless they're extended by Congress. But the president has a backup plan. He's initiated new Section 301 investigations into unfair trade practices of certain countries. These investigations are undertaken by the U.S. Trade Representative, or the USTR, and currently are in process. There's one investigation specifically addressing the use of forced labor in production, and the other investigation relates to structural excess production capacity. So depending on the results of these investigations, the long-term countrywide tariffs may be imposed again. The IEEPA tariffs were convenient for President Trump because under IEEPA, generally there's no special or lengthy administrative processes that are required to be undertaken in order to impose the tariffs, as long as the president declared a national emergency. On the other hand, these other statutory mechanisms to impose tariffs, such as Section 232 or Section 301, generally require lengthy investigations by an executive agency and specific findings of fact, an economic harm, or a national security threat to the United States before the president can order a remedy, which may include tariffs.
So the last time you were on the podcast, when we talked about what authority Trump had to impose these tariffs, you noted that the court is generally deferential to the president for tariffs imposed under Sections 232 and 301. Do we expect to see any additional challenges to the president's authority to impose the Section 122, 232, or 301 tariffs?
Good question. There is a question for the novel Section 122 tariffs of whether a trade deficit is an imbalance of payment issue and whether the imbalance is, quote, serious and large, as required by the statute. There have already been multiple lawsuits filed challenging the Section 122 tariffs. Switching gears and regarding the additional Section 301 tariffs, which are meant to address unfair trade practices, the courts could be skeptical that these tariffs are addressing unfair trade practices because they may closely mirror the tariff rates that had been imposed under IEEPA. Generally speaking, tariffs under Section 301 and Section 232 are reasonably targeted based on an administrative record and on a detailed investigation outcome. The required process subjects the tariff remedy to some procedural and substantive public scrutiny, for example, under the Administrative Procedures Act. But if it becomes apparent that these statutes are being used to essentially retrofit or re-engineer the IEEPA tariffs, I think we could expect to see additional challenges to the new tariffs under these statutes as well. It's already been publicly reported that Peter Navarro, the president's senior counselor on trade and manufacturing, has stated with respect to Section 232 tariffs that over time, what you will get is the equivalent of the IEEPA tariffs. So I think we could see some potential challenges to this tariff as well.
So when do you think we could expect to see the results of those Section 301 investigations?
Generally, these investigations have taken about 10 months as it goes through its statutory process. But in this case, I think we could see them completed as early as this summer, perhaps conveniently timed with the expiration of the Section 122 tariffs, which expire in 150 days from implementation.
So in summary, while the IEEPA tariffs are no longer in force, it appears that other tariffs that coincidentally look a lot like the IEEPA tariffs could take their place. Lou, what about the amounts already paid by importers under IEEPA? Does the court's decision address whether importers who paid these tariffs are owed refunds by the government? And if so, do they say how they would obtain these refunds?
The Supreme Court decision does not specifically address refunds, and there's significant uncertainty regarding how importers will be able to recoup the tariffs they paid under IEEPA. The government is currently developing an electronic refund process called CAPE, which stands for Consolidated Administration and Processing of Entries. And it's requiring importers to register and have a bank account for direct deposit, as CBP won't issue checks. So this will be a new process for many importers who want a refund. But that's merely an electronic process or tool. It doesn't address the critical question of who will have standing to take advantage of that process or be eligible to get their refund. So that question may depend on the facts of each particular taxpayer. For example, some taxpayers file civil action suits at the Court of International Trade or the CIT prior to the Supreme Court decision to preserve a right to a refund. The process for those taxpayers may differ from the process for taxpayers that did not file a complaint before the Supreme Court decision.
Starting with those taxpayers that filed civil actions at the CIT before the Supreme Court decision, what do they need to do to get their refund?
Those who file complaints prior to the Supreme Court decision are in a golden position because they are expected to get their refunds. The Court of International Trade has said that they will order reliquidation of those claims and the government will be judicially stopped from challenging that reliquidation. And the government actually has also stipulated that they won't challenge the refund claims by those plaintiffs or similarly situated plaintiffs. That's a quote from the stipulation. For other importers who subsequently file suit after the Supreme Court decision and arguably are not similarly situated, the government may potentially challenge those refund claims by these importers or may require that they exhaust administrative remedies to have jurisdiction before the Court of International Trade in any subsequent challenge.
So let's unpack that a little bit. What are the procrastinators, the taxpayers who haven't filed claim yet? What's their recourse?
There are a few different scenarios here. Importers can file what's called a protest with CBP within 180 days after liquidation of the customs entry. If the government denies that protest, the importer can file a suit with the CIT under jurisdiction for denial of a protest, which is Section 1581A. Importers could forego the protest with CBP and go directly to the court under Section 1581I. But there's a theory that if importers don't exhaust all administrative remedies, for instance, by first filing a protest before going to court, they may not have standing before the CIT under the residual basis. In short, there is some ambiguity, but the safest approach for an importer to preserve its right to a refund is to first file a protest with CBP and then go to the Court of International Trade if that protest is denied.
There appear to be several different potential approaches importers could take to get a refund, but is it safe to say, Lou, that everyone who wants a refund needs to do something?
Yes, everyone who wants an IEEPA tariff refund needs to take some sort of action. They have to be proactive, whether it's registering for the CAPE system, filing protests with CBP, or filing a civil complaint with the CIT. But they shouldn't be reactive, just waiting for CBP to issue them a refund because they'll be waiting forever. Regulatory deadlines or statutes limitations on civil suits may expire, potentially leaving the importer without a refund remedy. So they need to take some action.
Is the Trump administration expected to fight these refund claims in court?
As mentioned, those who filed complaints prior to the issuance of the Supreme Court opinion are expected to get their refund. For other importers, some refund is still looking possible, but the process is less clear and it carries more risk. And there have been public comments by the administration that are not helpful, indicating that it could be years before refunds get sorted out. So I think this suggests that there could be further litigation, although it's challenging at times to accept the administration's comments at face value. So it's unclear. It seems like CBP is in good faith working towards a process, but there are other comments from the administration indicating that it could be a while.
So in order to claim a refund, do taxpayers have to prove that they economically bore the burden of the tariff? So, for example, in many circumstances, the cost of the tariffs may have been passed on to the ultimate consumer, or the cost could have been split with an overseas supplier. Is that relevant to a refund claim?
Not necessarily, because the importer of record is the party that's liable for the payment of tariffs to the government, and they would be the party that's eligible for the refund. Now, there might be contractual arrangements in place to share the cost of the tariffs with either suppliers or consumers. As you noted, some importers split the cost of tariffs with their overseas suppliers. But in other instances, the importer merely passed on the tariff cost to consumers through price increases. So those situations do exist, but in those cases where there is no direct legal relationship between the consumer or supplier and the payment of the tariff to the government, there's less of an opportunity for a refund directly to those parties. If there is to be some tariff refund sharing, it would be purely on some contractual basis or some other legal basis. For example, there are already several class action lawsuits filed by consumers against big name companies seeking their share of the tariff refund.
So thanks, Lou, for walking us through the fallout from the Supreme Court decision. Let's shift gears a little bit now and talk about the role of tariffs in Trump's trade policy over the past year. Beyond raising revenue, a key justification for these tariffs was that they'd give the U.S. more leverage in trade talks. Has that actually translated into new trade agreements?
Yes, we have seen some trade deals resulting from this aggressive tariff posture, but I would view those deals to be more like trade framework agreements to distinguish from the traditional comprehensive trade agreements the United States typically enters into, like you might have heard USMCA or NAFTA. So these trade agreements like the USMCA or NAFTA are the results of years of negotiations by the president, typically through the USTR, and approved by Congress. So there's two branches of government involved. Here, the trade deals that have arisen as a result of the IEEPA tariffs are neither approved by Congress and are significantly lighter on details or rules of engagement between the contracting countries. So these new agreements tend to focus more on setting new tariff rates and on securing investment or purchase commitments by our trading partners, but don't provide the necessary teeth for enforcement that the traditional trade agreements do.
So now that the IEEPA tariffs have been invalidated, do the trade agreements that were negotiated in response to those tariffs remain in effect?
Well, there's a good argument that because the IEEPA tariffs are gone, the legal underpinnings for those trade deals are technically non-existent. However, most countries appear to be honoring the agreements for now to avoid potential further retaliation from the United States, trade or otherwise. So they seem to be in place for now. But I wouldn't be surprised if in the future we see some renegotiated rates.
So I know that there were initially concerns that the U.S. could be hit by retaliatory tariffs from other countries in regards to tariffs. Did we see those retaliatory tariffs materialize, or did the trade deals that were negotiated settle a lot of those issues?
Yeah, I think we have a mixed bag there, and it's case by case. So some countries like Mexico and India, for example, merely threatened retaliatory tariffs but didn't actually impose those measures. They chose to work towards a settlement or a trade deal with the United States. Other countries, however, like China, Canada, and the European Union, for example, did impose retaliatory tariffs and other non-tariff measures on the United States. In some cases, like the EU, a trade deal was eventually reached, withdrawing or limiting the retaliatory tariffs in exchange for some tariff concession from the United States. In the case of the EU, a 15% tariff ceiling was imposed on European goods. We've seen kind of a mixed bag.
With respect to tariffs that aren't reduced or eliminated by trade deals, what, if anything, can importers do to reduce their tariff burden?
We see importers now looking very carefully at their supply chains and looking to modify perhaps the goods country of origin, because oftentimes the duty rate varies based on the country of origin, which is where the goods are produced or where the goods are substantially transformed. So companies are looking to shift some of their operations in order to confer a different country of origin and perhaps get a different tariff rate. Other companies are looking very closely at their customs valuation and looking at what's in their current transfer price if they're sourcing goods from related parties, and perhaps unbundle some of the costs that go into that transfer price to reduce the basis for the tariff. So, for example, there might be some IP or services that were bundled into the price of goods, and now those could be separated out, charged separately, and some of them are non-dutiable under the customs law. So we're seeing companies really be very proactive, more so than in past years, looking at their supply chain, their customs valuation to try to get a lower tariff basis.
Lou, what are you keeping your eye on in the area of trade in the near future?
I think the results of the Section 301 investigations are key. Like I said, I think we can expect new tariffs imposed on various trading partners to kind of replicate the IEEPA tariffs that were determined to be unlawful. This summer, also, the USMCA trade agreement sunsets. A review is required in July, so we're looking to see whether the United States will continue its multilateral approach to North American trade with Canada and Mexico, or whether it will pull out completely or enter into some sort of bilateral arrangements with Canada and Mexico separately. So that's going to be really important to watch out for, since a lot of our supply chains are so intertwined between Mexico, Canada, and the United States, specifically in the automotive industry. And this will have a significant impact if the U.S. pulls out or renegotiates some kind of bilateral arrangement. Export controls will continue to be important. There's a continued focus on licensing exports of high technology and advanced chips, specifically to China. And then we're seeing more heightened enforcement from CBP with respect to customs compliance. The Section 232 tariffs on metals such as aluminum, steel, and copper, we're seeing a lot of questions or requests for information from CBP trying to figure out how importers are valuing these goods and whether they're paying the proper tariffs. First sale for export, which is a mitigation strategy that allows importers to go earlier in their supply chain and use a earlier price in their supply chain as a basis of customs value. This is being scrutinized by CBP. We're seeing a lot of questions from CBP to importers that are using first sale. So we're going to continue to see heightened enforcement in these areas. And then, of course, the CAPE, the refund mechanism that Customs is working on. Importers should be a little wary that this could be used as an enforcement tool or a targeting tool, because in order to get your refund, they're going to have to submit a lot of information to CBP, have a bank account, etc. And if you're going to raise your hand for a refund, it would just be prudent to make sure that your customs compliance house is in order, because I could definitely see a situation in this heightened enforcement environment where customs says you want a refund, great, but guess what? We're going to come and scrutinize you a little more closely and get some of that back through penalties or lost revenue that perhaps you haven't tendered in the past. These are the kind of things that we expect to see in the future, and an importer should really be thinking carefully about.
Thank you, Lou, for returning to the podcast to discuss the implications of the Supreme Court's learning resources decision and the current landscape of U.S. trade policy. And a special thanks to Michael Timmerman for his help behind the scenes with this episode. The IEEPA tariffs are gone, but how, when, and if taxpayers will receive their refunds is still unclear. In addition, it sounds like tariffs will stick around in one form or another for the time being, although it remains to be seen what exactly those tariffs will look like. The significant complexity in this space continues, and taxpayers will likely want to continue exploring available tariff mitigation strategies. As always, please stay tuned for future episodes of KPMG's Inside International Tax to stay up to speed on the latest developments in U.S. international tax. Until our next episode, take care.